Good morning and welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health. This is where we highlight the groundbreaking work being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. It's part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. I'm Joel Katz, and joining me this morning and this week is Dr. Kalol Patel, Director of Interventional Pulmonology for the Hackensack Meridian Central Region and Medical Director of the Lung Nodule Program for the Central Region. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning, Mr. Katz. How are you? Nice to be here.
Great. Nice to have you here. Well, we're going to go over a few things today. We're going to talk about asthma, severe asthma, COPD, severe COPD, and other things. So let's start with asthma. And what I really couldn't identify, if you asked me, maybe the difference between asthma and COPD, although I know COPD is much more serious. So if you could, let's start with asthma, and you could explain what that exactly is.
Sure, definitely. So asthma is basically a condition in which your breathing tubes are a little bit hyperactive. Your immune system is working to kind of attack the breathing tubes and you go into spasms. It's mainly a disease which you would hear it in teens or kids get it. There is an adult onset asthma too, but it's completely reversible. Whenever you take medications for it, it reverses itself and your normal lungs per se, it's episodic. Whenever you are exposed to certain things like pollens, or some people are allergic to dust, smoke, cockroaches, something like that, then your airways go into spasms, and that's what asthma is. Whereas on the other hand, COPD is a lung damage from chronic injury, mainly to cigarette smoking, which is the most common in the world per se, but otherwise some people from their occupations, if somebody is a sandblaster or working in construction and exposed to certain agents over a long period of time, they can damage their lungs. The lungs try to repair itself as much as it can, but eventually it starts scarring up and then you have COPD.
Right, and that is not reversible.
That is a little bit reversible, but it never goes back to normal again.
Okay, so you could live with it for a long period of time. It's my understanding that it's kind of like a death sentence. Once you have COPD, it's going to gradually get worse, and you're essentially suffocating slowly.
Yes, or if you have very severe COPD, it's not that grave like that. But yes, majority of them, if at all you intervene sooner, then you don't have to go that far out. So all of us, after we are 25, 30 years in age, per se, as they say, everything is downstream. After that, so we all lose lung function.
Roughly
about 100 mLs of lung function every year. And in COPD, what you have done is because of cigarette smoking or as the occupational exposure, you burn up through your buffer, so you have nothing to rely on even when you lose out on that.
Okay, so let's talk about asthma for a little bit. And did you say cockroaches?
Yes, cockroaches is actually the most common. So it's mainly seen in inner city hospital populations per se. But yes, majority of the population is allergic to cockroaches and cockroach droppings. You see those black droppings that they leave behind.
And you're saying that is the most common reason for an asthma
allergic
attack?
For asthma in kids, yep.
And wow.
The second one is the mold after that. So
this mold, okay. And then allergens and pollen, as you mentioned, as well. So there are medications, obviously, to treat asthma. But there are, we want to talk about the natural medications, the biologics, not the manufactured drugs. So what is the, what makes them, well, I guess it's kind of like when you say what's better, why is biologics better? Because it's natural, right?
No, not so kind of it's the other way around. So no, biologics are also, it's not natural per se, but they're also manufactured. So just to give you a small gist about what asthma means and the treatment part of it. So normally whenever anybody has asthma, you start off with inhalers per se to help reverse what the spasms you're having in your lungs. The cornerstone of asthma therapy is inhaled steroids. So we give some steroids to calm the immune system down, and it just relaxes it and takes it back to normal per se. However, in certain people, their immune system is like Hulk, like the Green Monster, the character per se.
Okay.
If you slap Hulk, he doesn't slap you back. He destroys the place. So that's kind of what happens in severe asthma. Whenever you're exposed to something, instead of just going into a spasm, your airway is locked down and you can't breathe at all. So you need something way stronger. in that regard. So that's where biologics come into play. It actually calms your immune system down a lot more. So back in the day, the only thing we had to calm immune system down was prednisone. If you heard of it, it's a steroid.
Sure, yeah.
However, it has its own set of side effects. There is a role of prednisone in asthma therapy, but we try to avoid it as much as possible. And these biologics work along somewhat of the same pathway as prednisone, but with less side effects or no side effects at all, and they're fairly safe. But it's like these are all injectables. Some of them are once a month. Some of them are once every 3 months you have to get an injection. And some of them are every 2 weeks, so depending on what's causing your asthma, what kind of blood profile you have. And you can be on one of these medications to help you out. But most people, even if they are on prednisone long-term, can get off prednisone once they go on biologics.
And the prednisone is inhaled? And
Inhaled and comes with a pill also. So
also a pill, okay.
No. Yeah, so normally we would try to do it inhaled. Inhaled is actually pretty good. It doesn't get into your bloodstream, so you have less side effects with it. However, when you take a pill, that's when the side effect profile goes through the roof. So you want to avoid it unless it's required. If you need it, you need it. There's no other way around it. But if you don't need it, we try to do it that way.
But do the biologics, when they are injected, does that eliminate the need for an inhaler?
So right now, most of them don't need an inhaler, but insurance requirements throughout the board are that they should. They will be on it. They require them to be on the inhalers, per se. So, but they don't need a frequent inhaler use in that regard, if that makes any sense. So the cornerstone of therapy is something called albuterol. It mm-hmm. reverses the bronchospasms right away. So if you have ever seen a fish out of water, that's the sensation what most asthmatics feel whenever they have their attacks. So as soon as you take the albuterol, you feel a lot better. But to go through that sensation again and again is not pleasant. So whenever somebody's on biologics, they never go through that sensation again. So that's a pretty big thing. They can get back to life.
So just so there's no confusion, albuterol is different from albuterol.
No, that's albuterol. Sorry.
It's the same thing? It's the same thing.
Yep.
Okay. Because I remember when my kids were younger, when they were infants, we used the, what's the machine?
Nebulizer,
yep. Yes. And we use the albuterol for that. Okay, so that is the same thing, and that would
so
make sense.
It's the
sense.
Same thing. It comes as an inhaler as well as a nebulizer for kids and babies. Normally, they would do that. Or if mm-hmm. somebody's really sick, that's when you use a nebulizer.
Yeah, they didn't like that.
No. that's the whole thing. Like, even the sensation of going through that is not that pleasant, so that's why this helps them out.
Because it was noisy and everything. It's time for the nebby, and they weren't happy. So using biologics, it doesn't necessarily eliminate the inhaler. Now, why, you talk about when you may have a asthma attack when you're breathing in allergens, but sometimes, and maybe this is because, when kids are doing sports, that when they, even indoor sports, and I say that because, I think there's more allergens outside than inside, correct me if I'm wrong, yet they still have asthma attacks.
So there's a group of asthma called exercise-induced asthma, in which there are certain individuals who have hypersensitive airways to begin with. So the airways are very sensitive. Whenever you are exercising, you're breathing hard, right? So the amount of air going in and out of your lungs goes up almost 3 to 4-fold during the exercise. And because of that, the airway mucosa dries out a little bit and you can go into spasms because of that. So that's what exercise-induced asthma is. So these people, they won't have any symptoms if they're not exercising. However, exercise is good for you, right, as we all know. So we treat them prior to exercise. They have to take the albuterol prior to exercise, like about 15 to 30 minutes prior to that. And they don't get the symptoms, and they're able to exercise properly.
Okay. And is that something that could go away with age?
Yes.
It does.
Yes.
Okay.
So most people can grow out of it. Yes.
Okay, that's good to know. I mean, my daughter, you explained exactly what it was with my daughter. Whenever she played basketball, and before a game, half hour before, she had the inhaler. So that's what you mean. Okay.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So the biologics, are they, how long have they been around, and how did they come about as an option?
The thought was, like, previously, whenever somebody had severe asthma, person in which they were on inhalers and on prednisone long term, they would have these side effects from prednisone, like their blood sugars would go up, they would gain weight, they would get diabetes, high blood pressure when as they get older. So because of that, there was a need for something, for a steroid-sparing agent, as we call it in medicine, so that you don't have to give steroids and you can give something in replacement of that. So there were a lot of studies done about it, and there is something called eosinophils. That's part of your white blood cell, like how in your defense forces, you have the Air Force, the Marines, the Navy. And that way, in your blood, the white blood cells also have different subtypes, and one of them is eosinophils, which is responsible for all allergic disorders. It's also useful to fight any hookworms and all helminthic infections, as we call it. But we, during the research, we found that eosinophils are the main cells which would cause your asthma symptoms. So they developed these biologics to work against these eosinophils. And there's something called interleukin-5. And they target it, and that's why you have better results without any side effects. It's like a shotgun approach versus a sharpshooter approach, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Prednisone is like a shotgun. It suppresses everything down, whereas with the biologic per se, it just works where it's supposed to, so there's no collateral damage.
That's much better. Why would you want to treat something that doesn't want to be treated?
Yep, exactly. Then you run into side effect profiles. And to answer the second part of the question, mm-hmm. they've been around for almost a decade, 5 to 10 years, depending on which biologic you're looking at. And there are new biologics in the pipeline, too. There is something in the studies right now which you only have to take one injection a year, and that takes care of your asthma. So, but it's still in research, per se. So there's a lot more to come, but it helps out quite a bit, and they have a very good safety profile about it. There are over 1 million doses administered, and people are doing quite well on it.
We're talking with Dr. Kalol Patel, Director of Interventional Pulmonology for the Hackensack Meridian Central Region and the Medical Director of the Lung Nodule Program. COPD, Chronic Obstructive Pulmonary Disease, or COPD.
COPD is lung damage from chronic exposure to certain toxins or something that they shouldn't be exposed to. And over a period of time, if you keep on exposing them to it, the lung damage keeps on increasing and getting worse. And you can have mild, moderate, severe, and very severe COPD. Mostly for the first, mild, moderate, and severe, there are inhalers like asthma, which we use, which improves lung function. However, it does not go back to normal, as I said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
However, in very severe COPD, you are on these medications and your quality of life starts going down. You're basically, even if you can barely walk up a flight of stairs, or you have to stop in between to catch your breath and not able to go to the bathroom. Like even activities of daily living, which we take it for granted, they're unable to do so. So in these patients per se, there are other options outside medications. Like you continue on your medications per se, but there are certain things that we can do to improve your breathing. Mm-hmm. Previously, back in the day, like I'm talking about roughly a decade ago, 10 to 15 years ago, we used to do surgeries in which we would cut out parts of the lung which are very damaged to improve the lung function, and they used to work. However, as you can imagine, these people are very sick to begin with because of the chronic smoking history and severe COPD. It was a tough thing for them to tolerate the surgery, but people who tolerated it did quite well. So there was a big push about seeing a less invasive way, like how we spoke about in asthma, to mm-hmm. see having less collateral damage and having much better outcomes per se in that regard.
Can you get COPD or severe COPD from smoking, even if you quit? Let's say you're a 70-year-old person and you quit smoking when you were 30. Can that...
It depends on how much you smoked and for how long. So how we gauge smoking is in pack year history, meaning how many packs you smoked and for how many years. So mm-hmm. if you smoke 2 packs for 10 years or 1 pack for 20 years, it's exactly the same.
I see. That's okay. Right.
So depending on the higher the number of pack years, the more chances of more advanced damage per se.
So you can get COPD 30 years after quitting smoking, depending on how much you smoked and how.
It's not that you get COPD 30 years after smoking. You probably had it for 30 years, but you just realize it by that time. Let me elaborate a little bit.
Right, I see. Okay, like, yeah.
it's like an iceberg effect. So as I said earlier, we start losing lung function as we age, per se, right? So normally, unless you are in professional sports, per se, whenever we don't use our lung function that much. We use about 40 to 50% of our lung function on our day-to-day stuff.
Okay.
We never need more than that. As we keep on aging, we keep on eating into that buffer, the other 50% which we are not using. But when you have COPD, you have destroyed that buffer by almost 30, 40% to begin with. So you only have 10% remaining, which you can eat up due to aging. Mm-hmm. And then you'll start getting symptoms. So the symptoms just started happening at 70 years because you had no buffer to begin with.
You lost the buffer.
Or less buffer to begin with.
So when you do something more strenuous, that's when you realize how much more difficult it is.
Yes, exactly. So okay. That's why it builds up to you and your exercise tolerance goes down.
Okay, so the options, you didn't mention oxygen, because people with COPD, yes, you often see them with oxygen tanks or little oxygen machines.
So whenever you have very severe COPD, they need, because they're not able to bring air in and out that much, so they usually go up on oxygen. They need supplemental oxygen to make up for all that difference, per mm-hmm. se. Exactly. And then that in spite of that, they still have shortness of breath, however, but it's a little bit relieved and they're able to do a little bit more. So yeah, but basically that's what it is. And there are multiple treatment options for that. So as I was saying earlier, so normally you do nebulizers and stuff like that early on, then oxygen, and then eventually we offer them something called lung transplant, in which you take out the bad lungs and put new lungs in. And it's a big, big deal, as it
yeah.
sounds like, right? You have to crack open your chest to put new things in. So there was a new innovation which happened roughly about 3 to 4 years back, in which we can do the same kind of therapy as lung volume reduction. Remember I was saying that we used to chop out bad parts of the lung before? We can do something in a non-invasive or a less invasive way, in which we put these one-way valves inside the lungs, per se, so that the areas of the lungs which are more damaged, there's no air going over there, and we are just directing it to the good areas of the lung where gas exchange can happen and it can absorb the oxygen.
Okay, so before you have to get to a lung transplant, which is the last resort, I would think.
Yes.
There is this little procedure, or I don't know if it's little or not, but there's a procedure where you can help the lungs breathe better.
Yeah, exactly. And it's pretty fairly dramatic. Like in my personal experience, I've done close to 40 to 50 of these. I had patients, so it's a spectrum of responses you get, right? So mm-hmm. my best case scenario or my poster child was a veteran who I treated who was able to walk only about 50 feet, before which he would have to stop to catch his breath, and he would only able to climb like 3 steps before which he would have to stop. We did the procedure on him, and on 1 week after the procedure, he climbed 3 flights of stairs to surprise his sister, and months later he was playing tennis, doubles, not singles, but still.
Like it matters, right? That's amazing.
That's, he was like, oh, doc, I'm not able to play singles. I'm like, okay, you're able to walk 50 steps before. I think so. This is a big deal. But yeah, and then the other case scenario, like I have a very pleasant female, one of my favorite patients, who was on 7 liters of oxygen. That's quite a bit, per se. Mm-hmm. After we did it, and she wasn't able to get out of her bedroom. The only place she could go is to the bathroom and back to her bed, and she was going to move into an assisted living place. After we did the procedure, she's now down to 2 liters. She drives, she lives alone, continues to live independently, able to breathe a lot better. So, yes, so when we are redirecting, it's like we're just redirecting traffic, right, to go the right way. So
right.
It doesn't jam up. So it helps out. However, there's a lot. There is extensive workup involved in that to see who will benefit from it, because you just want to do it if it's going to help the person out.
Yeah, so the second person you were talking about, the second patient, she yes. was laying in bed and taking in more oxygen. And then yes. after the procedure, she was able to move around, drive yep. On less oxygen.
On less oxygen, she's able to do whatever she wants. Like she can go everywhere and do everything. Before, in spite of oxygen, she was not able to do anything, just stay in her room.
Does she still need to have the oxygen, the mask on? Well, not the mask, the tubes on? Yeah, the mask.
Not all the time, but only when she's exerting herself. When she's resting, watching TV and stuff, she doesn't use oxygen. But whenever she's exerting herself, yes, she does.
Well, tell us more about this procedure.
It depends on how damaged the lungs are, right?
So right.
In that regard. So even if the other part, whenever we put these valves and we're redirecting the airflow, if that area is also very damaged, then you cannot help that much. But if it's less damaged, the better results you get.
Well, tell us more about this procedure, because this seems amazing to me. I've never heard of this. And you explained how it works, but what is it from the time of the day of the procedure to when it seems like it's a week that they're back to doing what they want to do. What's the healing time?
Majority, so let me walk you through the procedure. So what we do is we do it in one phase or two phases per se, in which we put half of the valves in one go and the other half about 4 weeks later. But after the second time when we do it, usually within 24, 48 hours, you'll start feeling a difference. Most of these patients cannot take a deep breath because the damaged area of the lung, air is being trapped inside and feels like an elephant is sitting on the center of the chest all the time. And the tough thing is they cannot even bend down. The moment they bend down, they're completely out of breath to tie your shoes or pick up something from the ground. It's a big deal for them. As soon as we do this, that sensation goes away. Majority of them, like about almost 60, 70% of them say that their breathing feels a lot better within 24, 48 hours. And as time goes by, usually by the end of a month or 2 months, majority of them are completely, they'll get the peak effect. And it can keep on incrementally increasing until 3 to 6 months. It keeps on getting better as time goes by.
And how long has this procedure been available?
So we were doing this procedure for other indications for almost, I've been doing it personally for 8 to 10 years for other indications. Okay. For COPD, we started doing it for the last 3 to 4 years.
And what turned on the light bulb to start using it for COPD? Like why?
So no, it was in studies before. So
okay.
For the 10 years, we were using it for something called air leak, meaning once you have some kind of lung surgery per se, your lung is not healing well, will use this valve to plug up that hole in that regards before. So it was because there was no other option at that time. So FDA had approved it for that. But for the COPD part, they had requested studies to be done. So the multiple studies done over this period of time to prove that it's safe and it works.
That's amazing. So it just had to be approved.
Yeah, it was the approval trial. Yeah, exactly.
Because
you have to, whenever you're doing something groundbreaking like this, you want to make sure it's safe, right? You don't want to. Safety comes first.
Okay, for the minute or two we have left, if you don't mind, I want to talk about these, when you do an x-ray or a scan of some sort, sometimes white spots will show up.
Yes.
And these are lung nodules. So we wanted to touch on those, if you can elaborate.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So lung nodules are very, very common, to say the least. So, like, if you scan, let's say, 100 people walking on the street right now, depending on if they're urban or rural where they live, almost more than half of them will have these spots, per se. More, we pick it up more on a CAT scan than on an X-ray, because CAT scan gives us a much better picture of the lungs. But majority of them are not concerning, but they are just a result of exposure or scarring from a previous infection or smoking or some kind of an injury that happened to the lung. However, lung cancer is the number one killer from all cancers for the last almost 4 or 5 years now. And that's why we don't want to ignore these nodules, because some of these nodules can be cancer, depending on what the clinical story is, like if you smoke or not, what occupation do you have, what family history do you have, and what does the nodule look like, with the size, the shape, the appearance, the location. Then we can decide on how likely that thing is cancer or not.
Mm-hmm.
I personally put them in 3 buckets, like low risk for cancer, intermediate, or high risk. And if it's high risk, you want to act on it sooner than later. Because if you get cancer earlier, you can cure them of cancer. There are very few things which you can be cured of other than infections, right? Right now, mm-hmm. The only thing that you can cure is infections. Even high blood pressure, we just control it. So if you catch cancer at an early stage, we can cut it out, and then you don't need to do anything about it. So that's why there is a big push about these pulmonary nodules, that if you see a nodule, you should get follow-up on it and make sure that everything is okay. At the same token, per se, normally if you yourself or you have a friend or coworker who smokes, then they should get these lung cancer screening scans done.
Mm-hmm.
in which we are looking for these nodules, and for the same things, as I said earlier, the size, the shape, the location, and the appearance, because these people are at risk for lung cancer. So if we can catch it earlier, we can help them out in that regard, so they don't have to deal with those consequences down the road, but worse outcomes.
Dr. Kalal Patel, Director of Interventional Pulmonology for the Hackensack Meridian Central Region and Medical Director of the Lung Nodule Program for the Central Region as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
For more information, go to jfkmc.org, or for a podcast of this show, go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. JFK Spotlight on Health is brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz, and we'll talk again next week.